to Allendale, New Jersey. I was in the fifth grade and quickly went from being a popular kid to being a popular target for bullies. From birth, I had lived in a modest house packed together with other modest houses in Yonkers. Nearly all of my relatives were from Yonkers, a blue-collar city on the northern edge of the Bronx, one of the five boroughs of New York City. My great-grandparents were part of a wave of Irish immigration to the area in the late 1800s. My mother and father grew up blocks from each other on the Hill, an Irish enclave in the northwest part of the city. My grandfather dropped out of school in the sixth grade to go to work to support his family after his father was killed in an industrial accident. He later became a police officer and rose to lead the Yonkers Police Department. Our home was immediately behind Public School 16, the school where I happily spent my early childhood years. My mother had attended PS 16. One of my grandmother's best friends was the principal. And by the time we moved, I was one of the most popular kids in my fifth grade class. Yonkers and School 16 were the center of my world. I could see the big red brick school through the tall chain-link fence separating my backyard from the school playground. My older sister, two younger brothers, and I would walk to school every day, circling the block, because the fence was too tall to climb. I knew everybody, and as far as I knew, everybody thought I was a pretty cool fifth grader. I fit in. I felt like I belonged somewhere. That was a great feeling. But it ended when my dad brought us news that changed my life. My father, Brian Comey, worked for a big oil company. He started out selling cans of motor oil to gas station operators and moved up to finding locations for new stations. For decades afterward, he could drive around the New York metropolitan area and show you the corners he spotted, his gas stations. In the 1960s, both the car business and the gas business were booming. When my dad took a new job with a company in northern New Jersey in 1971, it meant we had to move to a place that, until then, had existed in my mind only as tall cliffs called the Palisades. Yonkers sits on the eastern bank of the mile-wide Hudson River. In the spaces between the houses on my street, I could see the Palisades forming a dark stone wall on the western bank. I don't think I ever believed the world ended at that formidable wall, because we had driven to Indiana once, but it might as well have. We were moving to the other side of the wall, where a new world awaited the coolest kid in the fifth grade at School 16. I was not the coolest kid at my new school, Brookside Elementary in Allendale, New Jersey, something I figured out pretty quickly. My parents were always trying to save money, so my mother cut her boy's hair with her own electric clippers and dressed us in clothes she purchased at a Sears outlet. My pants were too short, and I wore white socks and heavy-soled black shoes to support the fallen arches in my huge feet. I didn't know it, but it turns out I had a New York accent different from the kids in Allendale. I stuck out like a sore thumb. The soreness quickly became more than metaphorical. One of my first days on the fifth grade playground, I was surrounded by a group of boys who taunted me in my looks. I don't remember what I said to them, but I probably said something, because I was a confident kid with a big mouth, even though I was not tough enough to back up what I said. They knocked me to the ground. The bullies regularly invited their victims to fistfights staged after school in a nearby park. I was called out numerous times but never showed up, walking well out of my way to avoid the park. I remember one time attempting to reason with one of the bullies when he said he wanted to fight me. "If you don't like me, and I don't like you, and then we punch each other in the head with our fists, what will that change?" I asked. The reasoning approach only made him angrier. Maybe if I had let one of them pummel me, they would have moved on to another target, but I didn't have the courage to try that. Much of the next 3 years was spent avoiding the bullies. I absorbed their verbal taunts frequently, but I was keen to avoid physical confrontation. I just wasn't tough or strong. So I kept to myself, played mostly with my two brothers, and walked odd elliptical routes around town. Allendale shared its high school with another town, so ninth grade offered me the opportunity to meet bullies from a whole different municipality. Again, they found me quickly. I'm not entirely sure why. I wasn't big, it wouldn't be until after high school, but I was smart and verbal, which may have drawn their attention. Although I was trying out for football, I was also in the choir. Maybe because they were seen as artsy or simply different, the choir boys seemed to be prime targets for abuse. Unlike the tough boys at my high school, I still carried baby fat and was from the first day a prime target for taunts about my body. Being body slammed into a locker hurt, but I could handle it. More dangerous were the wedgies. If memory serves, a wedgie involved ripping another boy's underwear out of his pants by grabbing the rear waistband of his underwear and yanking upward. The offense typically involved two assailants, and I endured several in the ninth grade. When the abuse began, I did nothing. I told no one. So it continued. Bullies would grab, pinch, and twist the skin on my chest or arm passing me in the hallway. Or if they couldn't get close enough to pinch, they would throw a hard punch to the shoulder. I learned to see them coming and get out of the way. So once again, I tried to avoid confrontation. This was harder to do in the locker room dressing for gym or during the 3 weeks of my football career. I tried out for the football team, but after weeks of being battered to the point where I severely bruised my coccyx, a part of my body that at that point was unknown to me, my mother finally had had enough. Without my knowledge, she walked across the street to Coach Murray and tendered my resignation. I was both humiliated and secretly relieved. My mother saw a truth I didn't see, and she put it higher than worrying about my disappointment. I wasn't tough enough yet to play football. Still, although my mother's unilateral action may have saved my life, it didn't stop the abuse from the other kids. I began to dress for gym in an empty locker room. Those were hard times, but thankfully, I had a couple of close friends and adults I could look up to, people who reminded me that I mattered, which is an easy thing to forget when you're a target for abuse. There were my parents, for starters. My parents were tough, but kind. They were report card on the refrigerator people, with the shakiest report card always seeming to be on top so your siblings could see it. They pushed us, but they also constantly supported us. My mother, Joan, would snap the shades open in my bedroom nearly every morning with the same catchphrase, "Time to rise and shine and show the world what you're made of." When I became Deputy Attorney General decades later, my parents gave me a snow globe with the scales of justice inside, and "Rise and Shine" inscribed on the base. It still sits on my desk. During high school, I would come home from school and sit with my mom to talk about my day. When she was dying from cancer in 2012, we spoke of those hours. Starting when I was a little boy, she told me much was expected of me. Before she died, my mother showed me a note I had written to her after getting sent to my room at the age of 7 or 8. "I am sorry," the note read. "I will be a great man someday." She had saved it in her dresser for almost 50 years. I also had some wonderful teachers with whom I became close, especially English teacher Andy Dunn, the advisor to the school newspaper, where I was an aspiring journalist. Somehow, although I had a couple of good friends, I connected better with the teachers at my high school than the students. And then there was a man named Harry Howell. During my junior and senior years of high school, I worked for Harry at a large grocery store near Allendale. I didn't make much money stocking shelves, retrieving carts, and working the cash register, maybe $4 an hour, but I loved my job. That was in large part due to the kind of leader he was. Harry was a trim white guy of average height, with tightly cropped hair, who wore a white short-sleeved shirt most days with his nameplate pinned to the chest pocket. He wore a black belt and black, brightly shined wingtip shoes, no matter what color his pants. As I see him in my memory, he bears a striking resemblance to a 45-year-old Robert Duvall. Looking back, even after working for presidents and other prominent leaders in and outside government, I still think Harry Howell was one of the finest bosses I have ever had. That was in part because he loved his job and was proud of his work. Harry knew the grocery business, having worked his way up to store manager. He insisted his store be the cleanest, best run in the entire corporate chain. The stock clerks, most of us teenagers, were a group of amateur comedians. We laughed during our work, much of which was done after the store closed, played practical jokes, and worked like maniacs to make whatever aisle we were responsible for look perfect. All of that was Harry's doing. Somehow he created an environment that was both demanding and incredibly fun. He suppressed a smile at our silliness, just letting the corner of his mouth turn up slightly so we could see his amusement, and told us bluntly when our work wasn't good enough. We loved him, but we also feared him in a healthy way. Because he made us feel important, because he so obviously cared about what he was doing and about us, we desperately wanted to please him. Harry Howell made me love the look and feel of a grocery store aisle that has been expertly blocked, or faced as some stores call it. With each can or package pulled forward to the shelf edge so the aisle looks clean and undisturbed to the customers, as if they are the first humans to find it. In pre-barcode days, we used handheld ink stamps to put prices on items sold in the store. This was a slow process that required great attention to setting the correct price on the stamping device. A pricing error would be tattooed in ink forever. During my stint at the store, the company invested in new technology, hard plastic label guns to put price stickers on items. We only had two or three of these prototype label guns because, we were told, they were very expensive. They were to be treated with extreme care. One evening, I was busy with my specialty, stocking the paper aisle. Paper towels, toilet paper, tissues, napkins. I was about one-third of the way up the aisle from the front of the store, cutting boxes open with my razor and using the fancy label gun to hit each item before filling the shelf. I was a blur of stocking excellence. Then I heard the voice of one of my fellow stockers standing at the end of my aisle. With urgency, he called, "Comey, let me borrow the gun. I just need it for a second." And he extended both hands in front of his body to catch the gun. Without thinking, I tossed it. The moment the gun left my hand, he turned quickly and disappeared. I can still see the expensive prototype label gun arcing through the air. In my mind, it's rotating backward, end over end, as it slowly flies the 20 or 30 feet to the spot where my coworker no longer stood. In my memory, I'm crying, "No!" in slow motion, but I doubt I had time to do that before that expensive gun landed at the feet of Harry Howell, who had conveniently stepped into my aisle. The gun smashed into pieces. My coworker had seen him coming and timed it perfectly. There are many leaders, and I've known a few in my life, who would have lost it, hurling expletives and accusations at a stupid kid. As Harry looked down at the plastic parts now spread around his wingtip shoes, he said only, "Clean it up," and walked away. I don't remember him asking for an explanation or mentioning it again. My 16-year-old self concluded that Harry immediately realized I had been scammed. In his stoic, suppressed smile way, he understood that I'd been the victim of a slightly mean prank and pitied me. Maybe the guns really weren't expensive, or maybe Harry made my coworker pay for the one that I had tossed. But Harry's grant of mercy left a lasting impression and made me love him more. I worked even harder, making the paper aisle a bounty-filled paradise. And I tested him again. One evening, I was assigned to stock the dairy case, which was a level of complexity far beyond paper. This was the big leagues. I pulled open the huge door to the dairy cooler in the far rear of the building to retrieve gallons of milk. They stood in tall stacks, 4 gallons to a plastic crate. In the days before plastic milk bottles, these were made of paper and looked like gigantic versions of the box of milk you bought with your school lunch. I grabbed a hand truck and began loading it with crates. Overconfident rookie that I was, I made it a big stack of 6 crates, holding 24 gallons of milk. My mother would have called it a lazy man's load. I tilted the 2-wheeled hand truck back, noting the impressive weight, and made my way out of the cooler, pushing my right shoulder into the back of the hand truck, left hand on top of the stack. I banged through the swinging backroom doors and rolled along the dairy display cases. The weight was making me go faster and faster, so I took quick steps to keep the stack from falling on me. At the milk display case, I stopped abruptly and pushed the hand truck hard upright, heedless of the basic laws of physics. The universe and the milk, of course, were not heedless. When I stopped short and heaved the hand truck upright, the crates kept going, momentum conserved, and fell like a towering tree in the very direction I had been pushing them before I stopped short. The tree of plastic milk crates hit the floor hard. Instantly, the tops of those paper gallons burst open in unison, dumping more milk in one place than I had ever seen before. a 24-gallon lake of milk began spreading along the dairy case and down the cereal, canned goods, and international food aisles. It was a catastrophe beyond words. I ran to the back, grabbed a mop and bucket, and began frantically soaking up lake milk and squeezing the mop with the mechanism on top of the bucket. It had all been so quiet. Paper milk gallons don't shatter. They just open. If I hurry, I thought, I might get this cleaned up before anyone sees the mess. I was minutes into mopping when Harry appeared. He stood on the far side of lake milk, hands on hips, careful not to get any on his wingtips. After an eternity of admiring the lake, he asked, "Have you learned something?" "Yes, sir," I replied. "Good," he answered. "Clean it all up." And he walked away. I was too young to see it clearly, but at 16, I was getting a look at great leadership. I knew I wanted to be more like Harry than the kids who tormented me on the playground. And maybe Harry was open enough to see that about me. Maybe he even instinctively knew what school was like for me, that I was a kid just trying to fit in somewhere and be something. Being an outsider, being picked on, was very painful. But in hindsight, it made me a better judge of people. In my life, I would spend a lot of time assessing threats, judging tone of voice, and figuring out the shifting dynamic in a hallway or locker room crowd. Surviving a bully requires constant learning and adaptation, which is why bullies are so powerful, because it's so much easier to be a follower, to go with the crowd, to just blend in. Those years of bullying added up, minor indignity after indignity, making clear the consequences of power. Harry Howell had power, and he wielded it with compassion and understanding. That wasn't always easy for him, because he had to deal with a lot of immature kids. Others had power, like the bullies at school, and they found it far easier to wield it against those who were defenseless and to just go along with the group rather than stand up to it. I learned this lesson, too, in one of the great early mistakes of my life. In 1978, I attended the College of William & Mary. I was one of many insecure, homesick, frightened kids living away from home for the first time, although we would admit none of that to one another, or even to ourselves. Because of overcrowding, I was among 17 freshman boys living in a physically separate annex to one of the large dormitories, without a resident advisor or any kind of on-site supervision. I shudder looking back through the lens of adulthood. My college had unintentionally created a Lord of the Flies dormitory annex. There was a boy in that annex who was mildly annoying. He was a bit arrogant and uptight and had a hometown girlfriend he talked about constantly. He had potted plants in his immaculately neat dorm room. He went his own way most of the time. But somehow the group of boys decided that this mildly annoying boy was not to be tolerated. So the group messed with his belongings, trashed his room, recorded voices over portions of his favorite cassette tapes, and performed other idiocies I can't remember. I was part of that group. Some things I did, some things I helped do, some things I laughed about after they were done. I created a Lord of the Flies dormitory annex. There was a boy in that annex who was mildly annoying. He was a bit arrogant and uptight and had a hometown girlfriend he talked about constantly. He had potted plants in his immaculately neat dorm room. He went his own way most of the time. But somehow the group of boys decided that this mildly annoying boy was not to be tolerated. So the group messed with his belongings, trashed his room, recorded voices over portions of his favorite cassette tapes, and performed other idiocies I can't remember. I was part of that group. Some things I did, some things I helped do, some things I laughed about after they were done. I caused someone else pain. 4 decades later, I'm still ashamed of myself. How on earth could I be part of bullying another boy? But I was. After all, everyone was doing it. Maybe I was afraid that if I didn't go along with this, I'd be the new target. Or maybe it was because I'd spent so many years on the outside of the group that I wanted in. I was one of the guys. Finally, I belonged. I was raised by parents who constantly emphasized the importance of resisting the group. 1,000 times, in many contexts, my mother said, "If everyone is lined up to jump off the George Washington Bridge, are you just going to get in line?" I gave a speech at my high school graduation about the evils of peer pressure. I carried in my wallet from the age of 16 a quotation by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. I just typed that without looking it up. Despite all that training, all that reflection, and the face of whatever guilt or hesitation I felt, I surrendered to the loud laughter and the camaraderie of the group, and maybe to a feeling of relief that I wasn't the target. I harassed and bullied another boy, who wasn't very different from me. I was a timid hypocrite and a fool. I was a living example of something I knew then and have come to know even better decades later. We all have a tendency to surrender our moral authority to the group, to still our own voices and assume that the group will handle whatever difficult issue we face. We imagine that the group is making thoughtful decisions, and if the crowd is moving in a certain direction, we follow, as if the group is some moral entity larger than ourselves. In the face of the herd, our tendency is to go quiet and let the group's brain and soul handle things. Of course, the group has no brain or soul separate from each of ours. But by imagining that the group has these centers, we abdicate responsibility, which allows all groups to be hijacked by the loudest voice, the person who knows how brainless groups really are and uses that to his advantage. Had my family stayed in Yonkers, where I was a cool kid, where I was part of a group, I don't know what kind of person I would be now. Being an outsider, being picked on, was very painful, but it made me a better person. It instilled in me a lifelong hatred for bullies and sympathy for their victims. Some of the most satisfying work I did as a prosecutor, in fact, was putting bullies of all kinds in jail, freeing good people from their tyranny. After my experience in college, I was never going to surrender to the group again simply because it was easy, and I was going to make sure my life had some meaning because I'd already seen how fleeting life could be. Chapter 4. Meaning. I have always believed, and I still believe, that whatever good or bad fortune may come our way, we can always give it meaning and transform it into something of value. Hermann Hesse. I have worked with great men over the years, but two of my most important teachers about life and leadership were women. In 1993, after my work on the Gambino trial ended, I kept my promise to Patrice and we moved our family to Richmond, a place where we had few connections but where we could raise a family more cheaply and comfortably. After working briefly at a law firm, I returned to work as an assistant United States attorney, this time in the Virginia State Capitol. The law firm was fine, the pay good, and the people smart, but I missed public service, even with its mismatched furniture and low pay. I couldn't tell my law firm colleagues this, but I ached to be useful again, to do some good for my community and to represent the victims who really needed me. My new boss was Helen Fahey. She was the United States attorney, the supervisor of all federal prosecutors in the eastern half of the state. Fahey's rise to the top was unusual and inspiring. She had stayed home with her young children as they grew, then worked in various roles for a Defense Department agency, starting as a typist. All the while, for 17 years, she pursued her education, as she told the newspaper, one job, one month, one class at a time. She never actually completed a college degree, but was admitted to law school anyway given her high test scores and work history. I was 35 years old when I started working for Helen in 1996. I was the supervisor in the Richmond office, one of four Fahey oversaw, and I had dreams of energizing it to make bigger contributions in all kinds of areas, especially against violent crime and public corruption. Having been an assistant United States attorney in Manhattan and a partner at a big Richmond law firm, I thought I was hot stuff, as my mother used to say, not meaning it as a compliment. Maybe unconsciously picking up on traits exhibited by Rudy Giuliani, I was everywhere in the city and became the face of federal law enforcement in Richmond, representing the office with local law enforcement, the community, and the media. A free weekly Richmond newspaper put a picture of me on its cover, calling me one of the good guys, and identifying me incorrectly as the U.S. attorney instead of an assistant. I had posed for the picture in my office in Richmond. Worse, I hadn't told my boss anything about it. A stunt like that back in Rudy Giuliani's office would have ended very badly. My first reaction to seeing the newspaper with me splashed across the cover was that I would be a dead man unless I seized every copy in the city. Then I remembered who I worked for. Fahey was secure enough to want me to succeed. She laughed at me a bit, which was appropriate and deserved, but she laughed with me more often. Helen Fahey was comfortable in her own skin in a way few leaders are. I think some derided her behind her back as weak. She let Comey take over Richmond, but she knew exactly what she was doing. She was letting me grow, gently smacking me behind the ears every so often to make sure I stayed on track, and getting good results in the process. And she also didn't care much what misinformed people said about her, a lesson I would find very valuable as I grew older. She put the interests of the team and the important job we had to do higher than her own feelings or worries about reputation. Our effort to prosecute gun crimes and reduce Richmond's homicide rate was bitterly resisted by some of the federal judges in Richmond, who saw those kinds of cases as unbefitting a federal courtroom. I didn't care, and my team in Richmond didn't care. We were trying to save lives, so we plowed ahead, infuriating one senior judge. He responded by issuing an order holding Helen Fahey, our U.S. attorney, in contempt for some minor administrative error, failing to put in a request to have the U.S. Marshals bring a prisoner to a scheduled court date. Fahey had nothing to do with the little pieces of paper we filled out to schedule prisoner movements. She typically came to Richmond once a month, and there was no conceivable basis for involving her personally. But the judge did it to rattle us and her. He didn't know Helen Fahey. The day of her contempt hearing, the courtroom, courthouse hallways, and street outside were packed with dozens of police officers and federal agents, including police horses and motorcycles on the street. Fahey walked calmly to the defendant's table in the courtroom and waited. The judge came out and was so rattled himself by the show of law enforcement community support that he began ranting about what a problem I was, ignoring Fahey entirely and directing his venom to the audience, where I sat. He then dismissed the case against her. She thought it was hilarious and told us we were doing the right thing and to press on. I owe my entire career in leadership to Helen Fahey's confidence, not just in me, but in herself. She glowed in the achievements of her people, who loved her back, and we blossomed in her glow. She had the confidence to be humble. But the person who taught me the most about leadership is my wife, Patrice. All of us have encounters with death in our lives. It's inevitable. I've had my share, even after the Ramsey rapist receded into my nightmares. There was, for example, the time I visited Patrice, who at this time was just my girlfriend, while she was in the Peace Corps in a remote village in Sierra Leone, West Africa, and her nearly died from contracting malaria. If she had not driven me in the middle of the night on the back of her motorcycle and literally dragged me into a remote hospital, I would not have made it. But sometimes it isn't when we face death ourselves, but rather when death takes away those we love the most, that we really learn about just how short our time on earth is and why what we do with that time matters. In the summer of 1995, Patrice and I lived in a 5-bedroom colonial on a dead-end street in a planned neighborhood in Richmond. It was the kind of place where the local fire company would bring the truck to your house on a child's birthday, where the neighbors all knew each other, where the kids spent endless hours out in the quiet street drawing chalk roads to play bike games. Our two little girls thrived in the new house and were joined by a little brother in 1994. And then came Colin. Colin Edward Comey was born on August 4th, 1995. He was born healthy, 7 pounds, 6 ounces, and like all Comey babies, he was long. Patrice nursed him at the hospital, and our three kids visited and held him. It was a wonderful day, one experienced by many parents with a newborn. But as that day wore on, Patrice sensed a change in him. He became strikingly irritable, so she kept asking the hospital staff if something was wrong. They assured her he was fine, and all was normal. One nurse patronized this mother of four, telling her, "You've just never had a colicky baby." He was not fine. We didn't know it yet, but Colin's little body was fighting a deadly infection. About one quarter of all women carry bacteria called Group B Streptococcus. The bacteria are harmless to the mothers, but can kill their babies. They can be reliably detected toward the end of pregnancy and easily treated with penicillin during delivery. But in 1995, that testing and treatment protocol was not yet a regular feature of American medical practice. Though some hospitals and some doctors tested for the bacteria, the medical association representing obstetricians had not yet endorsed the practice, and state boards of medicine had not made it a standard of care. By the next morning, Colin had a high fever and a raging infection in his blood called sepsis. Under extraordinary care in a neonatal intensive care unit, he battled for 9 days. He was soon on a ventilator, the machine inflating his little chest again and again. Patrice hardly slept and often drifted off while sitting in a chair by his side. She explained that he had heard her and touched her for 9 months, and he needed that voice and that touch more than ever. So she sat with him, hour after hour, day after day, holding his little fingers and singing nursery rhymes to him. The doctors then showed us the devastating brain scans. The infection had destroyed huge sections of his brain. Only the ventilator is keeping him alive right now, they told us. Your son is gone. But they wouldn't tell us what to do. They wanted us to tell them whether to remove Colin from the ventilator. How could we do that? He was there, alive, right in front of us, and we were being asked to give up and let him die. I went home to check on the other kids. My parents were staying at our house. As I typically am when under stress, I was calm, even a little cold. But as I explained to my mom and dad what was happening and the decision we faced, I burst into tears. I don't think either of them knew what to do. Back at the hospital, Patrice and I made the decision. In the midst of indescribable grief, she somehow saw what else needed to be done. Our other son was not yet 2 and couldn't understand what was happening, but our older girls could. For their sake, Patrice decided that they deserved, they needed, to face the truth. Once they knew the truth and could accept it, they would have a chance to see Colin one last time. The girls had held our baby in his first minutes of life, Patrice reasoned. They should hold him at the end. His death shouldn't be hidden from them, or it would loom too large as they grow. I never would have had the wisdom to see this. Expose a 5- and 7-year-old to their dying baby brother? Who would do that? A wise woman would, and she gave a gift to our daughters. They got a chance to say goodbye. To prepare our daughters for this, we took them out for a picnic, and through many tears explained what was happening and why. My mom then brought the girls into a private room shortly after the machines were turned off. Patrice was holding Colin and handed him to each of his sisters. The girls took turns rocking him and speaking to him, saying goodbye, and then handed him back. After the girls left, I held the little guy for a while, and then Patrice held him. His mother sang to him until he stopped breathing, and then long after. It's difficult for me even now to describe that scene as a broken-hearted mother rocked her baby to the end of his short life. We were very angry. Had Colin been born with another doctor or in another hospital that required testing, he would very likely be alive because Patrice would have been tested late in pregnancy and treated as she delivered him. But because he was born with a doctor who didn't support testing and in a hospital that didn't require all doctors to order it, he was dead. That didn't make any sense. Patrice dug into the science and developed a relationship with a researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and good people at the Group B Strep Association, made up of others who had lost babies. Infants were dying needlessly all over the country as the medical profession slowly pivoted and changed its practices. I can't bring our son back, Patrice said, but I can't bear the thought of another mother feeling the pain I feel. I've got to do something. She framed it in religious terms, based on one of her favorite lines from the New Testament. In his letter to the Romans, Paul writes, "We know that God causes all things to work together for good, for those who love God, for those who are called according to his purpose." She couldn't explain why a loving God would allow Colin to die, and she rejected glib explanations about God's will. She would reply, often to me after the well-meaning person had moved out of earshot, "What kind of loving God wants to kill my baby? I don't believe that." But she did believe she had to make something good come from her loss. That good, she announced, would be saving other mothers' babies by forcing all doctors to test. So she went to it, channeling her grief into a nationwide campaign. Patrice wrote publicly about our son and traveled the country supporting efforts to change the standard of care. She poured effort into speaking to the Virginia legislature and succeeded in getting statutory language passed embracing universal testing and treatment for Group B strep. She didn't do anything alone, but her voice, along with the voices of many other good people, changed our country. All mothers are tested now, and their babies live. Something good followed unimaginable bad. Other mothers will never know what might have been, which is as it should be. Patrice's quest to make things right for others undoubtedly influenced my own views on the purpose of the law and the justice system to which I've devoted most of my adult life. In the years that followed Colin's death, I have seen a lot of bad things happen to good people, and I've been asked to help explain it and give those losses some sense of meaning. In 2002, when I went back to serve as the United States Attorney in Manhattan, I stood in the freshly excavated pit at Ground Zero, a place where thousands died, including hundreds of whom no trace was found. I had invited the country's 92 chief federal prosecutors to that spot. I explained that those lost innocents were all around us, even though we couldn't see them. This was a place of suffocating loss. It was holy ground. Channeling Patrice, I told them that I didn't know why bad things happen to good people. I recalled that for those of us from a Judeo-Christian tradition, the book of Job rebukes us for even asking the question. The voice from the whirlwind replied in essence, "How dare you?" The truth is, I can't explain God's role in human history. To do that would require an understanding far beyond the loss of my son, and sweep in the suffering and loss of countless innocent sons and daughters. I just don't know, and I have little patience for those who claim to know. What I do know is what Patrice taught me. There is meaning and purpose in not surrendering in the face of loss, but instead working to bind up wounds, ease pain, and spare others what you have seen. Our obligation, our duty, is to ensure that something good comes from suffering, that we find some kind of gift in goodbye. Not to somehow perversely make the loss worth it. Nothing will ever justify some losses. But we can survive, even thrive, if we channel grief into purpose and never allow evil to hold the field. In that mission lie the beauty and genius of our justice system. Patrice and I were planning to stay in Richmond forever. We had good public schools and a nice and relatively inexpensive house in a safe neighborhood. After Colin's death, we had a healthy baby girl in 1996 and added another in 2000. We would raise the five kids in Richmond. I would do work I loved. We were set. Then the country was attacked on 9/11, and my phone rang. I was home from work one day in October 2001 watching the two youngest girls. Patrice was at church for the foundational meeting of a women's group she was starting. She spoke inspiringly to the women about growing old together. But she couldn't hear our phone ring from there. I heard it at home and answered. The man said he was calling from the White House because the president would like to know if I would be willing to return to Manhattan as the United States Attorney, the chief federal prosecutor. I assumed it was one of my hilarious friends, so I began to say, "Yeah, why don't you kiss my a-" when the man cut me off, saying this was not a joke. President George W. Bush needed to appoint a new United States Attorney. There was something of a political logjam in New York over the pick, and they had decided I was the right person. I had worked in that office, I had done terrorism cases, and I would be acceptable to Democrats and Republicans. Would I do it? It's difficult at this distance to capture the feeling of the fall of 2001, a time of unity and purpose and anxiety in the country. "Of course I will do it," I replied. "But my wife's not home right now. I'll call you back if she has a problem." I hung up the phone, abandoned my caregiving responsibilities, and went out to stand in the driveway to wait for Patrice, my heart pounding. After what seemed like hours, she came driving up in our red Ford minivan. She got out, took one look at my face, and asked, "What's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong," I answered, standing in the driveway without my little girls. "A guy called from the White House and asked me to be the U.S. Attorney in New York." Her eyes started to well up. "You can't say no." I didn't say no, but I told him I would call back if you had a problem. She began crying, her open hands covering her face. "I'm going back to New York. Oh, my God, I'm going back to New York." We were going back to New York, where the World Trade Center site still smoked. I would lead 250 prosecutors with hundreds of cases, ranging from terrorism to violent crime to corporate fraud, including what would be one of the most high-profile cases of my career. Patrice opened the minivan sliding door, and the large ceramic plate that had held the bagels she took to church slid out. In a moment that was hard not to take as a prophetic metaphor, it shattered on the driveway. Chapter 5. The Easy Lie. He who permits himself to tell a lie once finds it much easier to do it a second and third time, till at length it becomes habitual. He tells lies without attending to it, and truths without the world's believing him. This falsehood of the tongue leads to that of the heart, and in time depraves all its good dispositions. Thomas Jefferson. When Martha Stewart was released from prison in March 2005, the press was making much of the fact that her net worth grew during her time in custody, as if the goal of prosecutors had been to destroy her, rather than punish her for lying during an investigation and send a message that people, no matter who they are, can't obstruct justice. I was in Las Vegas giving a speech and knew the media would try to get an ambush reaction from me on camera because I was the United States attorney who had indicted her and received an enormous amount of media attention and criticism as a result. As expected, a camera person and a local reporter with a microphone approached. The reporter stuck the microphone in my face and said breathlessly, "Mr. Comey, Martha Stewart is getting out of prison today worth $200 million more than when she went in. How does that make you feel?" I paused, looked into the camera, and delivered a line I had practiced in my head a dozen times, willing myself not to smile. "Well," I said slowly, "we at the Department of Justice are all about the successful reentry of our inmates into society. Miss Stewart may have done better than most of our convicts, but that's certainly no cause for concern." Stone-faced, I nodded and walked off. The reporter had no idea I was fooling around, but the camera person, they tend to be the more down-to-earth members of a media team, laughed so hard that the camera bumped up and down. The shot was too shaky to use. Martha Stewart didn't commit the crime of the century. At first, I found it an annoyance compared to those we were dealing with on a daily basis, cases that had a bigger impact on people's lives. But something caused me to change my mind. This case was ultimately about something higher, something more important than a rich person trying to sell some stock before it crashed. And in a number of ways I couldn't imagine then, it had a significant impact on me for the rest of my career in law enforcement, offering lessons I'd make use of long after. Everyone lies at some point in their life. The important questions are where, about what, and how often. One of the inevitable questions someone at my height is asked, especially by strangers in elevators, is whether I played basketball in college. The answer is that I didn't. But it was a long story as to why, involving growing late, knee surgery, and various time demands. I figured nobody wanted to hear all that. Even if they did, it took too long for an elevator ride. So for a few years after college, I took the easy way out and just nodded or said, "Yep," to any stranger who asked me that question. I did the same thing with friends I played basketball with once I entered law school. I don't know why I did that. Maybe I was insecure. Maybe it was just easier. Or maybe I liked people to think I was a college jock. This was a seemingly small and inconsequential lie told by a stupid kid. But it was a lie nonetheless. And it ate at me. So after law school, I wrote to the friends I'd lied to and told them the truth. They all seemed to understand. One of them replied, as only a true friend could, "We knew you didn't play in college, and we didn't care. You're a great friend and a great player. Of course, you suck for other reasons. I guess what concerned me most about the small lie was the danger of it becoming a habit. I've seen many times over the years how liars get so good at lying, they lose the ability to distinguish between what's true and what's not. They surround themselves with other liars. The circle becomes closer and smaller, with those unwilling to surrender their moral compasses pushed out, and those willing to tolerate deceit brought closer to the center of power. Perks and access are given to those willing to lie and tolerate lies. This creates a culture, which becomes an entire way of life. The easy, casual lies, those are a very dangerous thing. They open up the path to the bigger lies, in more important places where the consequences aren't so harmless. Every year, a small number of people are prosecuted for insider trading. A few people wearing nice suits and handcuffs get paraded in front of cameras and walk into courthouses, but their cases generally go without much notice outside the financial press. But in January 2002, that was about to change, when a case about one little-known biotech company with one well-known shareholder came across my desk as the United States Attorney in Manhattan. In late 2001, Sam Woxall, owner of a company called ImClone, sold his many shares of the company in a panic after learning that regulators were going to deny a license for ImClone's new wonder drug. The problem for Mr. Woxall was that the general public didn't know anything about the denial of the license. Under the law, a CEO can't just sell his stock when he learns something big that ordinary stockholders don't know. That's insider trading. Woxall's behavior was like lighting himself on fire in front of law enforcement authorities. That he was guilty and should be charged was obvious. The remaining question for investigators was whether anyone else who sold ImClone shares after Christmas 2001 did so based on material, non-public information. Because the transactions happened in Manhattan, which was my jurisdiction, I assembled an all-star team of assistant U.S. attorneys to help run the investigation. My deputy was David Kelly, a career prosecutor and close friend. The chief of the criminal division, supervising all criminal prosecutors in the office, was another longtime friend and former prosecutor, Karen Seymour. I had convinced her to leave her partnership at a Wall Street law firm to help me lead the office. Together, the three of us chewed over all hard decisions, like the old friends we were, laughing, teasing, arguing. I valued them because they would always tell me the truth, including when I was full of it. The danger in every organization, especially one built around hierarchy, is that you create an environment that cuts off dissenting views and discourages honest feedback. That can quickly lead to a culture of delusion and deception. In a leader, the tendency of too much confidence to swamp humility can lead to a dangerous self-indulgence at the expense of others. That was a major factor in the downfall of the mafia in New York. And ironically, it was a significant weakness at the U.S. Attorney's Office that broke the mafia under Giuliani. I worked very hard to keep this in mind now that I had Rudy Giuliani's old job. It was now my responsibility to build my own culture within the U.S. Attorney's Office, one that would get the best out of our team and drawing, in different ways, on the lessons of Giuliani and Fahey. I tried to attend to this task from the very first day. I hired about 50 new prosecutors during my time as U.S. Attorney and sat with each of them as they took the oath of office. I invited them to bring their families. I told them that something remarkable was going to happen when they stood up and said they represented the United States of America. Total strangers were going to believe what they said next. I explained to them that although I didn't want to burst their bubbles, this would not happen because of them. It would happen because of those who'd gone before them. And through hundreds of promises made and kept, and hundreds of truths told and errors instantly corrected, built something for them. I called it a reservoir. I told them it was a reservoir of trust and credibility built for you and filled for you by people you never knew, by those who are long gone. A reservoir that makes possible so much of the good that is done by the institution you serve. A remarkable gift. I would explain to these bright young lawyers that, like all great gifts, this one comes with a responsibility, a solemn obligation to guard and protect that reservoir and pass it on to those who follow, as full as you received it, or maybe even fuller. I would explain that the problem with reservoirs is that they take a very long time to fill, but they can be drained by one hole in the dam. The actions of one person can destroy what it took hundreds of people years to build. On the Waxel case, government investigators, including agents and analysts at the FBI, ran through the basics. They got a list of everyone who had sold ImClone stock at the same time as Waxel. One of those names was Martha Stewart. She had dumped her shares the same day Waxel did, and before the public learned about the FDA denial on the new drug, avoiding a loss of about $50,000. The loss was a rounding error for a wealthy person worth hundreds of millions of dollars like Stewart. But investigators would have been negligent if they didn't at least interview her and ask her why she sold when she did. Stewart was a friend of Waxel's, and investigators expected her to tell them that when she learned Sam was selling his stock, she'd sold hers too. Surely she would tell them that she didn't know there was anything wrong with that sale, and that she was very sorry if there was. There would have been a stern warning, maybe a modest financial penalty, and everybody would go on with their lives. Except that wasn't what Martha Stewart did. Instead, she told the investigators that she had a standing agreement with her broker that he should sell her ImClone shares immediately if its stock price dropped below a certain price or floor. Stewart said she had known nothing in advance about Waxel selling his stock. Maybe his sale had caused the price to drop, triggering her sell order, but that was all a big coincidence. Nothing to see here. Federal investigators usually aren't big believers in coincidences. Stewart's answer prompted them to look further. Among many oddities, they discovered that Stewart and Waxel had the same broker. They also learned the broker had called Stewart the morning of Waxel's sale. Stewart was unavailable at the time, flying by private jet to a Mexican resort. So the broker left a message with Stewart's secretary, saying that he needed to speak to her about Sam Waxel urgently. After the investigation began, the feds obtained handwritten notes from the broker. Those notes did reflect that there was a previously agreed-upon floor for selling the ImClone stock, just as Stewart had said. But the notes were written in two distinct inks. Everything was written in one brand of ink, except for the part that bolstered Stewart's claims. Investigators then learned other troubling details. They interviewed Stewart's secretary and learned that after the federal investigation into the ImClone sale began, Stewart asked her secretary to open the telephone message from her broker on her computer. Then Stewart asked her secretary to stand up, after which Stewart took her seat at the computer. She highlighted the part that said her broker was calling about Sam Waxel, then typed over it to remove the reference to Waxel. Stewart then paused. Apparently thinking better of obstructing justice in such a clumsy way and in full view of a potential witness to a major crime, Stewart stood abruptly and instructed her secretary to restore the word she had just deleted. I disliked the Martha Stewart case from the beginning. It was a distraction, a shiny object. We had so much more important work to do. The tech bubble of the late 1990s had burst, and dramatic swings in the market had exposed an extraordinary amount of corporate fraud. To paraphrase the memorable words of Warren Buffett, when the market crashed, the tide had gone out quickly and exposed a lot of naked bathers. There on the beach were the fraudsters of Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, and so many more, those who had bankrupted companies, destroyed countless jobs, and defrauded billions from investors. We were working like mad at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York to make these big cases. And they were very hard to make, because they all turned on the content of people's minds. In a drug-dealing prosecution, of which I had done many, the mission for the government was simply to connect the defendants to the transaction. If federal agents burst into a hotel room and find a kilo of heroin piled in the middle of a table, everybody sitting at that table is going to jail. It isn't open to any of them to say it had never occurred to them that this activity was illegal, or that their accountants and lawyers had reviewed the heroin and concluded it was lawful and appropriate under governing rules and regulations. Nope. Everybody is going to jail. In a corporate fraud case, the challenge was reversed. At the end of the day, the government would understand the transactions completely. We would know who was sitting at the table and exactly what the deal was. But everybody at the table would say they had absolutely no idea this complicated, mortgage-backed, reverse repo, foreign exchange swap transaction was illegal. They would invariably say they were deeply, deeply sorry people had lost their life savings, but committing a crime was the furthest thing from their minds. It fell to investigators and prosecutors to prove the content of a person's mind beyond a reasonable doubt, to a jury of 12 who must unanimously agree that the government met its burden. Really hard. Not impossible, thanks to the 20th century's great gift to law enforcement, electronic communications, but still hard. Sometimes email offered kilo on the table kind of evidence. In one case I dealt with, a financial executive emailed another saying, "I just hope the SEC doesn't find out what we're doing here." His fellow executive replied, "Forget the SEC. When the FBI comes, I'm going out the window." Good stuff. But more often, the government was stymied in its effort to prove criminal intent, even in the face of huge financial losses. People shouting that the CEO must have known or should have known was not good enough. Where's the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he knew he was committing a crime? Senior executives are shocked, shocked, that lower-level employees may have been breaking the law. In the middle of all these massive cases that we were working so hard to make, why did I want to have anything to do with Martha Stewart? It was a marginal case about a lie by a rich person who sold some stock because her friend did. We had some evidence that might add up to insider trading if we took an aggressive view of the law, and we had a willful obstruction of justice, but it was far from an open and shut case, particularly if it involved a jury and a sympathetic character in America's most beloved TV hostess. Everyone had learned something from her. I once had personally pushed basil leaves under the skin of a Thanksgiving turkey at Martha Stewart's suggestion. Why go to the trouble? Who cared? But the case was no longer marginal when one afternoon the lead investigating assistant U.S. attorney barged into my big office with its view of the Manhattan end of the Brooklyn Bridge and NYPD headquarters. All day long, I could watch people flow to and from Brooklyn and to and from the police. With a broad smile and both arms extended above his head as if signaling a touchdown, he told me he'd gotten the goods. The final piece to the case had come, unexpectedly, from Martha Stewart's best friend, Mariana Pasternak. Just days after the allegedly coincidental stock sale, the two were sitting on a hotel balcony in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, enjoying a New Year's vacation drink. As they chatted, gazing out at the jewel-like Pacific, Pasternak told investigators, Stewart said she was worried about Sam Waxel. Stewart explained that she had sold all her stock in ImClone because she learned through her broker that Waxel had. She added, "Isn't it nice to have brokers who tell you such things?" In other words, Martha Stewart had told us a whopper, and now we could prove it well beyond any reasonable doubt. Ugh. The lie she had told was so unnecessary. She could have offered to repay the $50,000 she had saved, chump change to her, expressed remorse, and vowed never to trade on insider information again. Instead, she engaged in an elaborate deception and then involved others to try to cover her tracks. In addition to a celebrity fan base who cheered her on, Stewart had aggressive lawyers. One of their main arguments was that it was laughable to think that a person worth hundreds of millions of dollars would get personally involved while jetting to Mexico to sell stocks simply to avoid a $50,000 loss. Her time was too valuable for such trifles, they said. Faced with this argument, I asked her lawyers a question. If Ms. Stewart were at her country estate and walked to the end of her winding driveway one Sunday morning to retrieve her New York Times, steaming cup of coffee in hand, and saw a $5 bill lying on the ground next to her paper, would she pick it up, or would she not bother with such a trifle? They didn't answer. Of course she would pick it up. Of course she would make a single phone call to her broker to save herself $50,000. Most of us would, especially if we weren't familiar with laws on insider trading. I asked Karen Seymour, the criminal division chief, to see if she could arrange a plea deal. Karen didn't love that idea because she now had a strong case and worried we would signal weakness by looking for a deal, but she gave it a shot. Stewart's lawyers at first said she would go for a guilty plea, then said she would not. My guess is they were either testing our resolve or had failed to persuade their client into pleading in a case she couldn't win. If we wanted Stewart to pay for her crime, we were going to have to indict her and try this case against a well-known and widely admired public figure. Though the case seemed like a no-brainer, I still hesitated. I knew defenders of Stewart in the media would say just what her lawyers intimated to me when they fought against the charges, that I was bringing this case to get famous, that I was celebrity hunting, tipping the scales of justice to make an example out of someone who had been in the public eye, that I was just another Rudy Giuliani out to make a name on the backs of others. I spent long hours staring out at the Brooklyn Bridge, hesitating to bring on the criticism and the circus I knew would come. Then, while I worried about myself and my image, I remembered a young black minister.